Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. In this lecture, we're going to look at how the distribution of military capabilities across the international system affects the overall level of economic cooperation in terms of trade. I'm going to argue that it does so, in part, by determining whether the most powerful state in the system goes around forcing states to allow imports. We're still talking about when and why states might forego the benefits that come from specialization in trade, which has been our focus for a few lectures now, but I should acknowledge that we're also talking about coercion at this point. I'm not telling you how to feel about the fact that powerful states have often forced weaker states to adopt policies they did not wish to adopt. Whether your sympathies lie with the anti-imperialist left, or the neocolonial right, or whatever, is none of my business. I'm just trying to add another layer to our understanding of the first big puzzle I laid out at the start of the module, to give you a better sense of why we see more trade in some periods than in others, understanding that trade guarantees that there will be more stuff to go around, but does not guarantee that it will be distributed equally. That is, I told you in the very first lecture that one of the big puzzles in international relations is why there isn't more cooperation, and that the answer couldn't be as simple as cooperation isn't always good. I then identified a number of reasons why states might not cooperate, even if they agreed that they were going to be worse off as a result of their self-interested behavior than they could have been under some alternative outcome. Some of you might have thought those problems can't be too severe, that cooperation generally does prevail when the benefits are real, because you've lived your whole lives in an era marked by very high levels of economic cooperation. In this lecture, though, I'm going to try and convince you that globalization was far from inevitable, that the period we're living in currently does not resemble the past and may not resemble the future. That is, I'm going to argue that the end of the Cold War, which took us from a bipolar system, one with two superpowers and a system of alliances formed around those poles, to a unipolar one, played a critical role in the transformation of the global economy. It's no coincidence, in other words, that most of the increase in trade that I mentioned in the very first lecture, 2,700% from 1950 to 2005, occurred in the latter half of that period. The era of globalization, in other words, overlaps almost perfectly with the post-Cold War era. There are a variety of reasons for that, some of which have to do with factors we won't discuss in this lecture, but I think there's a strong case to be made that the distribution of military capabilities is part of the reason why coordination, collaboration, and trust problems aren't forcing us to live in a world with low levels of economic cooperation. They have in the past, and might again in the future, if we move back to a bipolar or multipolar world. The argument consists of two parts, making up the two goals for this lecture, which, as always, you can find on the first slide. I'll start off with a relatively simple game-theoretic model that will demonstrate that when the most powerful state in the system is particularly dominant, they're more likely to force other states to allow imports, but when their advantage isn't as big, they're unlikely to do so. Second, I'll present the results of statistical analysis that provides evidence of trade relations in the real world operating as our very simple model expects them to. Okay, turn to the second slide. There, you'll find an extensive form game. This one is slightly more complicated than the very first one you saw, in that there are three decision nodes rather than just two, but it's simpler in the sense that I'm not going to introduce uncertainty. I could, of course, and that would be more realistic, but it wouldn't do anything to alter the substantive conclusion we're going to draw from this model. So let's keep it simple and pretend the two sides can easily guess how the other will behave, implausible though that might seem. As usual, we only have two players. H is the hegemon, that's a fancy term for the most powerful state in the system, and L is some less powerful state. In principle, the theoretical argument I'm developing here could apply to interactions between regional powers. Because the focus of this lecture is on the system as a whole, however, we're going to think of the stronger player as the strongest in the system. The game begins with H deciding whether to demand access to L's market or not. That is, demand that L allow imports from H, even though H does not necessarily intend to import anything from L. In fact, we'll assume that they don't intend to, just to provide an easy answer to the obvious question of why L needs to be coerced in the first place. Again, we're not necessarily talking about cooperation in the same sense as in the previous lectures. There's a harder edge to it this time. The trade relations are going to be imbalanced. But we are going to identify conditions under which the total amount of trade in the international system will be higher, and that does mean there's more stuff to go around, which benefits every state to at least some degree. So, H either demands that L allow imports, or does nothing. If H does nothing, the game ends, and both sides get a payoff of zero. Nice and straightforward. If H makes the demand, then L has to decide how to respond. They can either acquiesce, a fancy word for giving in, or reject the demand. If they acquiesce, the game ends, and each side gets the equivalent payoff from the exploitation outcome in the model of trust. That is, if H succeeds in getting L to allow imports, even though H isn't going to do the same in return, then H receives tau, and L receives beta times E. Note that I've dropped the subscripts for terms that used to apply to both players, but only ever go with one in this model. We're going to assume that E is negative in this case, even though I said before it can be either positive or negative, because otherwise there's no reason for them to be playing this particular game. So if L acquiesces, both sides will be better off in a strictly economic sense, but the benefits won't be shared equally, and L is going to feel worse off than before. That could be an emotional response on the part of the leader, or simply reflect the domestic political backlash he or she expects to face. We'll talk more in a future lecture about how trade policies that are good for a country as a whole can do real harm to certain segments of society, and how the losers can sometimes threaten a leader's hold on power despite being less numerous than the winners. What if L rejects the demand? Well, then H has to decide whether to back down or to coerce L, by which I mean force them to open up. In a sense, even issuing a threat is coercive, but at this stage of the game, we're talking about more than mere threats. For the sake of simplicity, I'm going to assume that they can, in fact, do so. It's going to cost them, but there's no doubt in anyone's mind that they're capable of forcing L to allow imports. In reality, powerful states sometimes do find it surprisingly difficult to force weak states to change their behavior, but let's set that aside for now. If H backs down, they'll suffer some loss of reputation, and that effect is picked up by the minus R. In other words, H is assumed to be better off not making a demand in the first place than making one and then not following through on it after L resists. How much worse off? I don't know, maybe not much at all. Reasonable people disagree about how much this sort of thing matters in the real world. Either way, it's not terribly important at the moment, though. Let's just say that H isn't going to make demands they're not willing to follow through on, even though that does sometimes happen, to keep this lecture from being too long and the algebra from being too messy. L, incidentally, simply gets zero when H backs down. I suppose we could give them some benefit, some reputation gain for successfully defying the hegemon, but there's no need to go there. The overall argument wouldn't change if we allowed for that. If H decides to go ahead and force L to allow imports, each of them will get the same payoff they would have gotten if L had simply given in to the demand initially, but they also pay some costs. So that's not a very good outcome for anyone. That's an idea I'll elaborate on in the future. Okay, let's talk about what happens in equilibrium. There are two possibilities overall, but they're non-overlapping. That is, if we put hard numbers on everything, we could say for sure what would happen in that particular case. That wasn't true in the model of coordination. There were multiple equilibria that existed at the same time, and that made it hard to say what would happen. Here, when the hegemon is relatively strong, which would allow them to force L to open up without incurring a very large cost, they're going to get their way without even having to bother. When they're weak, the cost they'd pay for forcing L's hand is so high that they're not actually willing to pay it, and L knows that, so they don't bother making a demand in the first place. We could, of course, complicate things by adding uncertainty, or treating attempts at coercion as gambles that only pay off with some probability, but we'd still arrive at the same basic conclusion. L is more likely to allow imports as H's dominance over the rest of the system increases. In a more realistic model, H would actually have to force L to change their behavior in some cases, instead of relying on mere threats, and wouldn't always succeed for that matter, but the same basic relationship between how powerful H is militarily and the likelihood of weaker states eventually opening up their markets would emerge. So I'm presenting the simplest model that gets us there. Okay, let's go through the analysis in a little more detail. When H is weak, as indicated by them having to pay a larger cost to force L to open up their market, one so large that they're not even willing to pay it, they'd back down at the final stage, assuming things even got that far, which they won't, because L knows that H would back down if they did. Since L prefers 0 to beta times E, L will reject H's demand when they know H isn't willing to follow through, which, admittedly, could happen for all sorts of reasons. We're focusing on one, how powerful H is, but I should say that all that really matters at this point is whether H is willing to pay that cost. I think it's safe to assume that the stronger H is, the more willing they'll be to do so, which is all that needs to be true for the overall argument I'm advancing to work, but other factors would certainly matter as well. Note that when L knows that H will back down, H never makes a demand in the first place, according to this model, because of that reputation cost. When H is strong, and can therefore make L open up without incurring too large a cost, they make the demand, and L acquiesces immediately. Here, L knows that if they reject, H is just going to force them to allow imports anyway, and that's going to leave them even worse off than they would have been if they'd given in, because the outcome will be the same overall, but they'll incur some costs along the way. So the game will end with L opening up their economy, even though H technically didn't force them to do so, though they certainly threatened them. What does this tell us? Simply put, we should expect to see more economic cooperation in the form of higher levels of trade when the most powerful state in the system enjoys a very large advantage over everyone else, but we can't necessarily expect that when their advantage is smaller. The sorts of problems we discussed previously should ordinarily inhibit cooperation to a considerable degree, but the world economy will be more integrated when someone's on top who has the resources to push people around fairly easily, which has been true more or less since the end of the Cold War, and was at times in the past, but hasn't always been. The reason why we expect more trade when the most powerful state is really powerful, again, is partly because of coercion. There are other things powerful states do that promote trade, creating international institutions, ensuring that key shipping lanes remain unobstructed and free from piracy, bailing states out when they get into financial crises that threaten to spread to the rest of the system, persuading states to adopt fixed exchange rates by offering to compensate them in some other way, etc. But we know that they also do resort to coercion. A recent paper in the top journal for research in economics, for example, found that CIA interventions are associated with a subsequent increase in imports of American goods, but not exports to the U.S. Again, I'm not claiming this is the only reason that trade flourishes under powerful hegemons. It's the one highlighted by the model we just discussed, but that model could very easily be tweaked to illustrate other ways that powerful states promote economic cooperation. As we transition here to the empirical part of the lecture, what I want you to focus on isn't so much the coercive part of the story, which I do think is legit, but the overall pattern. We're looking for evidence that the amount of trade in the world as a whole increases when the most powerful state enjoys a larger advantage over its nearest competitors, and decreases when that state is only slightly stronger. Incidentally, we could extend this argument to link the strength of the most powerful state in the system to the overall level of compliance with international law, respect for human rights, stewardship of the environment, participation in defensive alliances, etc., provided that we thought the hegemon cared about those things. Many people have made such arguments. I won't explore them in depth here, but if anyone is interested in that, I'd be happy to refer you to some additional resources where you can read more about such claims. Power can be used in a lot of different ways, and some of them are thought to be pretty benevolent. Whether U.S. hegemony, in particular, has been more of a force for good in the world than bad is something that people disagree about, as I'm sure you're aware. I'm not really interested in debating that. I just want you to be aware that economic cooperation is not the default state of international relations for all the reasons we've discussed in previous lectures. Whether you're a globalization cheerleader or critic, it's important that you understand how we got here. Changes in communication and transportation technology are part of the story, arguably a rather large part. But so is U.S. hegemony. That's what I want you to take away from this lecture. Okay, turn to the next slide. For each year from 1870 to 2006, the period for which trade data are available, I add up all the country-level imports to get the total amount of trade in the international system for that year. One country's exports is another's imports, so there's no need to count both. Note that this data set is considerably smaller than the one I discussed in the lecture on trust problems. instead of hundreds of thousands of observations, we only have 137. That's because we're not analyzing dyads, but the system as a whole. That's just one observation per year. The list of independent variables is also smaller. There's basically just one, in fact, though I've measured it two different ways. I included a few other factors for statistical reasons, but they aren't worth discussing, and so I didn't even put them in the table. The only independent variable we care about captures either the percentage of military capabilities controlled by the most powerful state out of the top two or the top three. Note that military capabilities are measured using the M scores that I discussed in the lecture on mathematical preliminaries. For the two-country measure, if you're curious, that ranges from 0.5, the US at the peak of the Cold War, to 0.6, the UK around 1900. As I'm sure you already knew, the world has never seen dominance like that of the British Empire at its peak. So I'm going to show you the results of two models. Each takes into account temporal trends, which aren't terribly interesting for our purposes, but help give us a proper baseline for comparison, as well as some measure of how powerful the most powerful state is, which is what we care about. In one case, that measure is relative to the next most powerful state. In the other, it's the next two. I could have done that relative to all the other states in the world, of course, but then we'd be measuring the total number of states in existence more than anything else. If you turn to the last slide, you'll find a table summarizing the results. The middle column tells us that there's a positive and statistically significant pattern of association between the strongest state's share of military capabilities out of the top two and the total amount of trade in the system. And the column on the right tells us that the same is true when we measure the strongest state's share using the top three states. In other words, years in which the most powerful state in the system enjoyed a relatively large advantage over its nearest competitors are years in which more trade occurred, taking into account the general trend over time, which is increasing, though not linearly. Years in which the most powerful state enjoyed a smaller advantage, by contrast, were years with lower levels of trade. Again, we can't be sure we're seeing the expected pattern for the reason we expect to see it. Statistical analysis can never tell us why a pattern exists, only whether it does, given a certain set of assumptions. Put differently, I have no way of knowing how much of the relationship between the strength of the most powerful state on the one hand and the total amount of trade taking place on the other stems from coercion, bribery, establishing international institutions, and fostering global norms, or, for that matter, pure coincidence. Anecdotally, we can point to examples of coercion, such as the United States forcing Japan to open its market under threat of naval bombardment in 1854, or the study I mentioned earlier about covert operations and U.S. imports. But I always try to be careful not to go beyond what the evidence allows us to say. The takeaway point is that we have theoretical reason to believe that states will often forego the benefits of cooperation, but are less likely to do so when there's a powerful hegemon that's willing to take a whole range of actions in order to promote economic cooperation. And the historical record provides evidence that higher levels of cooperation have occurred when the strongest state had a larger advantage over its nearest competitors than when it had a smaller advantage. It's up to you to decide what to make of that, as well as whether that's a cause for celebration, outrage, or something in between.